Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMS says they are closer to finalizing a plan to bring education back to the classroom just as parents start demanding an end to online education. The city kicks off its Corridors of Opportunity program in the Bates Ford Road corridor. Every single council member, every single one of them, is now the subject of an ethics complaint. We'll get to the bottom of that. And we look at COVID, the Carolinas and COVID, the Panthers and COVID, college and COVID, and President Trump and COVID. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE's political reporter Steve Harrison. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning. Annie Ma is here. She's education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Hello to you.
Morning.
Eric Spanberg is senior or managing editor. I've promoted you. Managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning.
Hello, Mike.
And Glenn Berkins is here. He's founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Glenn, welcome.
Good morning.
So at this week's Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board meeting, there was one thing on parents' minds.
We deserve to know where things stand on our students returning to school.
What I'm looking for is my kids to get in-person learning, and I want a date.
Someone needs to get things moving here.
To which CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston replied,
I can confidently say that we're closer than ever to that particular date.
So at that meeting, more than a few parents told the board that remote classes aren't good for students. So Annie Ma, were they the ones in the majority, or do most people want to stay online? What's the deal?
It's hard to say. I think they are certainly a vocal slice of parents in CMS, but you know, I watch these board meetings as they are live streamed online, and I see a lot of comments on the side through the live feature of parents saying that remote's working for them, they want to stay home. And I've talked to parents across the range of the spectrum. It's just hard to break it down. But I will say, you know, like the district's offering a full remote option, and before school even started, about a third of the district opted in, and that's like 50,000 kids. So it's just really hard to say. I do think, you know, the people who are frustrated with their situation, who might want to go back to in-person, are probably the ones who are more inclined to speak up at a board meeting. But you know, their frustrations are real, and they represent a not small part of how parents are feeling.
So there's two sides to this send them back, keep them home argument, and the two sides sound a little bit like this.
Reopen schools for in-person instruction immediately. I'd love to put my kids on a bus Monday morning.
I'm here to ask you to wait to send our children back to in-person instruction.
So, rock and a hard place for Ernest Winston, but Ernest Winston has said they're moving closer to developing metrics to be used to make a decision about when and if to send kids back. Yesterday, they released those metrics, and they hinge on the trajectory of the virus locally. Annie, what metrics will they use?
So there's going to be a lot of them in their district-level considerations, as well as county and school-level ones. The ones that kind of hinge on how the community does and how we all mask up and social distance is the number, it's two metrics. They're kind of complicated. The first is the 7-day average of the positivity rate. So that's like the percent of people who get tested who are positive. And CMS will consider bringing all students back if it's sustained around under 5%. But right now we're in this like yellow zone where they're prioritizing students who might need in-person learning more. And then the other metric is, I hope I don't get this wrong, it's the number of new cases per 100,000 people over 7 days. So they'll look at those both of those metrics over a 14-day period, and they've broken out like colored zones. And if we stay for 14 days in a certain zone, that's when they'll consider shifting to that plan. Right now, over the past couple of weeks, Mecklenburg County has sort of been in that middle zone, which, like I said, is where they prioritize, where they bring in like less than all of the district students back for some form of in-person learning. And you know, the district has said that their priorities are going to be like kids who need it more. Like, frankly, a high school senior does not need to be in person as much as like a 6-year-old first grader or second grader.
So you mentioned these color-coded designations. They released yesterday, I guess, a draft would be the word to use, a draft of a dashboard that they will be putting up, I guess, online. And it gives green, yellow, and red ratings to where we are. Green would mean what? Minimal community spread, which means we could go back to in-class instruction. Yellow is where we are now. That's moderate spread. Red means substantial community spread. Are they developing this dashboard so that parents can go online and see where we are? And can we depend that if we move into green, that the next week we'll be back in class? How will that work? What's the point of the dashboard?
I think the point of the dashboard is there are so many decisions, and I only talked about like the county health decisions. There's also mm-hmm. like district operational metrics. Once kids are back, there are inevitably going to be cases, and there's school level metrics. I think the idea of the dashboard for decision makers is to get all of these things that they have to look at in one place and be able to consider them as a whole system, as a whole decision making matrix. And for parents, I think for people in the community, it's, you know, they talked a lot about transparency and wanting to, you know, put this out there. Parents need to be able to make informed decisions. And I want to say it was Kathy Elling or Carol Stanford, both who are pretty senior officials in the district, who, you know, said this thing that I thought was very on point. You know, it's not a secret that it's not a secret. It shouldn't be a secret. Like, they're going to put as much as they can out there.
Steve.
So I think one thing that's interesting, Mike, is that CMS formed this advisory committee to create these metrics. And then the first meeting was private, which was against the law. And they said, you know, we made a mistake. But then at Thursday's meeting, they just produced these metrics after having no public discussion about them. I mean, they just showed up. And so, you know, I always kind of thought that the point of the committee was to discuss them in public and have a public discussion about, should we use this, should we use that? And there was at one point in the meeting where the teacher representative on the board or on the committee asked, where did these come from? You know, because he obviously wasn't in the loop. And so it's you know, the metrics committee, they got behind to get behind closed doors and created the metrics. And then the committee seems to be just kind of for show to have a bit of discussion about it and move on.
We seem to be having a lot of these, we made a mistake by having that meeting in private situations. Is that just because we're in this COVID situation and setting up these meetings on Zoom or whatever the platform is that they use is more complicated? Or would this be happening even if COVID was not a factor and they were having these in the council chamber?
Well, it's hard to say whether it would be happening anyway, but I do think that the circumstance we're in makes it easier for government groups to say, oops, we forgot, you know, whether the excuse or the reason is because of a Zoom call or whatever it is. I do think that is one of the costs we have right now in terms of transparency and the public knowing, is because it is so easy to say, well, you know, people can't come together for a meeting, so we'll just go off and do this.
But why?
Well, typically when this happens, it involves committees and things like that, or ad hoc committees or groups that have been appointed temporarily to study something that is in the public trust. These kinds of things have been happening for a long time, long before COVID. They know that city council meetings have to be open. They know that school board meetings have to be open. It's when they deviate from that and form these study groups or something to look at a particular issue that these issues are more likely to become a problem.
And to your point, Glenn, there was the Charlotte Mecklenburg Business Roundtable. When that was first appointed, the county manager said, no, these will not be open. In other words, they will not be shared virtually. And then there was pressure, there was public outcry, and then they became a public meeting. So I think that's an important part of the conversation, obviously.
Andy.
And
go ahead, Annie. Sorry.
It's obviously not just a CMS problem. Like, the county runs into that, city runs into it. I will say for CMS, one thing that crossed my mind is that there are, like, the superintendent has a lot of advisory committees that are not necessarily public, like the standing teachers advisory committee, his principal advisory committee. I would not be surprised if part of the confusion is that a lot of the people on the metrics advisory committee it was formed by the superintendent and most people were district staff. I don't know exactly how the legality splits, but there are certainly cases where, like, I don't think his board of teachers giving him advice about how teachers feel is necessarily a public meeting.
Steve.
I was going to say another, I think, key question, and maybe this will come up in the school board meeting next week, is with the metrics, you know, the key metric is that 5% test positivity that I don't think the county has ever reached since the start of the pandemic. So are they going to really keep that as a really red line? Is that going to be a definitive line? I mean, if we hover around 5.3, 5.4, 5.5, 6, are they going to just stay in the yellow and not bring kids back to school? And I think that's an important thing of, like, are these metrics guidelines or are these really firm, uncrossable barriers?
They said they were guidelines, and they really emphasized that point, you know, like it's just part of the decision-making process. I will say, like, if 5% is what the health experts on this panel came up with, and there's, you run into the issue of, like, well, you don't want to, like, move that metric to get to your goal. You don't want to sample on the variable that you're looking for. So I think they've really caveated a lot of that.
But by the way, the 5% is a national, I mean, that's a standard that's being used everywhere. They didn't just dream that up. Yeah.
So we are at 6%, if I've got the numbers right. We're adding about 91 new cases per day in Mecklenburg County, which adds up to around 55 to 60 cases per week on average. Let's go back to these color codes for a second, Annie. Right now we're in the yellow zone. Maybe you said this, but I think it bears repeating if you did. The metrics that they're using to decide where we are they based on the number of people testing positive, the number of hospitalizations, the number of known cases in Mecklenburg County? What are they based on?
So they're based on one of the things you said, which was the positivity rate, the number of people testing positive. Okay. And it's also the second metric they're looking at is the number of new cases per 100,000 people over a 7-day period, because that gives you a better sense of, like, it kind of cancels out the fluctuations. And Gibby Harris said, the public health director, said there are other metrics, but these are the two that are most relevant to understanding transmission, which is the concern in schools. Hospitalization is an issue. All of these things are issues, but they are less focused on the thing they're trying to figure out.
So these are guidelines. We're at 6%. They would like it to be at 5%. And yellow indicates positivity rates of 5 to 10%. And a rate of 10 to 100 new cases per 100,000 residents over 7 days. All these numbers get lost on the radio. But if they're just guidelines, would they be prone, as parental complaints grow, to say, okay, well, we're at 6%, we'll go back, as opposed to 5%, which seems to be, as Eric pointed out, the national standard?
So the thing that CMS is also looking at is that both of those metrics, if they're in green, they consider they're taking a more conservative approach. It's, if they're both in green, then for 14 days, they'll consider going to in person. But if one is in yellow, they'll consider switching out. And right now we're solidly in yellow for the number of new cases per 100,000.
So when they make this decision to go back, would it be a system-wide decision? I mean, if there are pockets of coronavirus, COVID clusters, as they're calling them at the college level now, in, say, Southeast Mecklenburg, would everybody else go back but Southeast Mecklenburg? Or when they make the decision, will it be system-wide? I have 20 seconds.
I think the county has not released as much granular information, but they have kind of resisted making that characterization.
Okay. More to talk about with this dashboard that CMS has released. And a bunch of other things that happened this week. We'll talk about those with our panel of reporters when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. We're here with Steve Harrison, who's our WFAE political reporter, Annie Maas, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Birkins is founder publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. So Annie, five CMS parents have sued the district over opening with all remote instruction. They say the decision deprives students of their constitutional rights to a sound basic education, and that CMS has put the needs of teachers above those of students. I'm not sure that there is a constitutional right to public education. I'm not sure about that. But the parents are asking the court for a preliminary injunction that would force the system to bring students back and then hold a jury trial. Wow, where does all this stand? Who wants to talk? Annie, go ahead.
There's a lot going on in that lawsuit. Part of what they're asking a jury to find is that the North Carolina Educators Association, which is this like loose advocacy coalition for teachers, and CMS engaged in illegal union activity. And I'll just say, as someone familiar with unions, I came up in the newspaper industry through unionized shops. Like, that's not how collective bargaining works. Like, as far as I can tell, all NCAE did was organize their members to talk to public officials about how they felt. And that is not the definition of collective bargaining. It is not an illegal work contract. So that part feels like just an odd curveball in there. In terms of there's the Leandro case, there is this in North Carolina, a guaranteed right to a sound basic education, but it's mostly been used in, in the Leandro case, which is about school funding to rural students. It's been used in cases regarding school segregation and desegregation. This is an interesting tact on it. I think it's worth noting that one of the plaintiffs who is suing the district even admitted himself on Twitter that his child is not that affected by remote learning, that he has the resources to provide everything his children need. So I think that it's just one of those conversations that's certainly happening on the surface, and there's something going on underneath all of it.
So I'm being told by one of our producers, Chris Miller, that there is a constitutional right to an education under the North Carolina Constitution. I automatically defaulted to the U.S. Constitution, and it's the phrase in that Constitution says, the people have a right to the privilege of education, and it is the duty of the state to guard and maintain that right. Okay, so that suit's underway. That will go on for a while. We may be back in class before they get a decision on that. But CMS is already planning to bring some students who have disabilities for in-person learning back to class by the end of this month. Will that be independent of this dashboard we talked about in the last segment and the guidelines that have been set forth for bringing back the rest of the students?
I think so. I mean, since the beginning, they have talked about EC, which is how children with special needs are designated in CMS, as a different consideration. When they voted to go to Plan C, a carve out within that was that EC students would get in-person evaluations and those with the highest need would get, I believe, one-on-one or at least in-person instruction. So it is a separate but parallel conversation that's happening within the district. And I think the date they set is September 29th for EC students.
And WFAE asked for and received a draft of a plan that outlined the approach to starting a Plan B schedule. Once again, is this draft separate from the draft of the dashboard? Is this a separate item, Annie, or do you even know? Okay.
Yeah, so I wrote about that last week. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so both start with the youngest students in the three-week rotation that the district had set up in July going back to school. The first model brings pre-K through grade 3 back first, with older grades being phased in over 15 weeks, and then pre-K students attending continuously with the rest alternating. The second model brings back 6th and 9th graders in the first round and allows everybody to return in 9 weeks. Why is this age or grade level based?
I think it's just, you know, become clear to the district, and I think they anticipated it, but the scope of it has really formed in their minds that it's really difficult for the youngest children to participate in online learning. You know, as you get older, like, I've talked to district officials who say, you know, like, my kid's in middle school and they're like, it's like, obviously we'd rather be in person, but by middle school, you can kind of figure out what's going on. I think it's the best in the district's mind. It's the way of balancing these safety concerns. It's, and like, introducing as few variables as possible into this new system of in-person rotational learning while still prioritizing and lifting up the kids who need it the most.
We learned yesterday that the president, or 2 days ago, that the president knew early on that this virus is spread through the air, and that's the way it most easily spreads. And that is why we wear masks, and that is also why people are concerned about being in enclosed spaces like classrooms. And yesterday, CMS released a list of 39 schools that lack outside airflow, which means they recirculate the air in the building, creating concerns about safety. Among those 39 schools, and these are just a few of them, Alexander Graham, Amy James, Dilworth, East Meck High, Garinger, the math building at Myers Park High, North Meck, Northwest School of the Arts, Old Providence, Providence High, Selwyn, South Meck, West Meck, and more. They have air optimizer projects scheduled or underway at 25 other schools, but not all schools can handle that. What would these projects accomplish, these air optimizer projects? Have they explained that yet?
They briefly touched on it during yesterday's metrics meeting, so I apologize to the CMS staff who do this work if I butcher it, but I believe it involves taking apart the HVAC system and scrubbing and replacing all the parts to get it to 100% airflow relative to its design, because, you know, as things age, it gets older and it's less efficient.
And these 39 schools where that is not possible, is that not possible because of the design of the HVAC system, because of the ductwork in the building, both? Why? You don't know. Okay, that's fine.
That you're is not a an great engineer. Question.
Look, you're not an engineer. You don't have to know everything. Once again, it is important to note that medical experts say social distancing and wearing masks in public are our best defenses against this, like it or not, against spreading this virus. And until the spread decreases, opening schools and businesses and our lives will take longer. And by now, you would think that everybody knows this. Everybody understands their personal role in bringing back the economy. But over the Labor Day holiday, there were parties all over the area, evidently, including one business in Matthews that hosted outdoor parties with well over 100 people. Several nightclubs opened over the weekend, despite prohibitions against doing so. Police shut down several gatherings of 70 or 80, some of which were passing around buckets of beer. That'll lower your inhibitions. And so Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris is now warning of a spike in the COVID virus in the coming weeks.
Actually, the behavior we saw over this past holiday weekend is probably more significant than what we saw over the last two holiday weekends.
And of course, those holiday weekends were the 4th of July and Memorial Day. And Harris added, more and more, we're seeing people frustrated, waiting to get back to normal and just saying, forget it, I'm done with this, I'm just going to go do what I want to do. Well, the result is more cases, longer closures, greater economic hardship, not having kids in classrooms. So when Mecklenburg County commissioners received a report this week about COVID's impact on this community economically, from job losses to food insecurity, Commissioner Mark Jarrell, he just couldn't sugarcoat it.
People are doing bad. People are doing bad. When you look at this, this is gut-wrenching.
Now that we know that the president knew that this was going to be bad, and he knew that wearing masks would be helpful, and yet he discouraged all of that because he lives in a fantasy world, do you think that people will get the message that wearing these masks will actually help us get back to normal quicker? Or are we going to be keeping to fight this battle all through the fall, into the winter, into next spring?
Well, I think, Mike, you know, people have their beliefs, and facts don't get in the way. We've seen this over and over again with so many issues. So,
but isn't that a recipe? Isn't that a recipe in a logical person's mind? Isn't that a recipe for failure?
Well, I mean, clearly, look at what's going on in the world. Yeah, we have plenty of examples of people not following these scientific guidelines and the disastrous results that follow. But your question was, is this going to continue to be a problem and a trend? Absolutely, it is going to be. There's no question. And we've already started talking about the vaccine and whether people will trust the vaccine and think it works. So, you know, listening to Gibby Harris this week was quite dispiriting, because she was so clearly disturbed and disappointed and frustrated by what she sees coming in the next couple of weeks based on the behavior of last weekend.
Glenn.
One of the things I think we have to recognize too is that up until now, this pandemic has mainly played out during warm weather months. We are now going into cooler weather months where people are going to naturally go inside. And that's also coinciding with, if you will, seasons where people like to gather socially and party. Halloween parties, Thanksgiving, Christmas. Mm-hmm. Unless we get that message that you talked about, Mike, we could really see a spike going into fall and even into winter. You ask about people's unwillingness to wear a mask. You know, I kind of compare it to people who insist on texting while driving or whatever. People simply don't believe it will happen to them. They always think this is something that will happen to someone else until it happens to you or someone you care about.
Steve.
I was just going to say, I mean, like, you know, maybe I'll just give the glasses half full piece for a second. You know, the health director really concerned about the spike. And I think then the other side would be that, you know, if you look at what has happened in North Carolina over the past month, when colleges came back, there was a big increase in cases. But that's gone down. And we're back now on daily cases to kind of where we were before colleges went back. Now, part of that is, you know, some of the schools like UNC and NC State went to online, but there are still a lot of colleges that are doing in-person. I think most universities and colleges are in-person classes. If you look here at Mecklenburg County, there are charter schools that are back. There are private schools that are back. So I think that there is, you know, it is not necessarily you know, we're on a path of doom. And I think 2.5 phase was definitely less significant than two. I mean, there's just not that much difference between the reopening we are in now and the reopening in May.
So one more thing go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say, if I can continue on Steve's path of optimism for just a moment, I guess another positive is that there does, just anecdotally, as you're out and about in the world, and y'all probably seen this too, I mean, more people wear masks and social distance now than they did 2 months ago or 3 months ago. So maybe that trend continues, and that helps us a little bit.
So one more story about schools before we move on to other topics here. WFAE's Ann Dawes Helms, our education reporter, Annie, reported yesterday that CMS spent $1 million on floor coating and hand dryers, neither of which fight the coronavirus. They bought a Microban top coat product for floors at a cost of just over $250,000. And in a presentation to the school board in August, a slide read that the product would, quote, provide additional protection from germs that can be spread from shoes and inhibit the growth of virus-causing bacteria. I'll come back to that. But a disclaimer on the company's own website says their product's active ingredients are not currently proven to have any antiviral properties when built into products. And viruses and bacteria are two different things. They are not interrelated in any way. They aren't linked. So how could an educational institution make this mistake?
I cannot speak to their thinking or intentions. I'm sure virus-causing bacteria was a well-intentioned typo. I will say, you know, in districts across the country, there has been this push to, like, basically eliminate as many variables as possible. It's not, you know, like, people are going to be quarantined if they're symptomatic. And if I get the stomach bug, if I get an allergic reaction, I'm going to appear as if I have the coronavirus. I'm going to topple my classroom, which will now quarantine, because I'm going to have to be isolated until my test comes back, and there's delays on that. So I think that, to my knowledge, like, that's probably their rationale for it, and the rationale of many districts. You know, like, if COVID is the only thing we can't protect against, then at least we don't have kids bopping around spreading other germs and getting sick and toppling the entire experiment of bringing kids back to school, is my best understanding of the thinking behind that.
And they spent about $658,000 on electric blowing hand dryers. The science is not completely clear on this, but the Mayo Clinic says that paper towels are more effective because you use them and dispose of them, and the virus, if it's on your hands, goes in the trash. whereas the hand dryers can blow it around the room. So the mayor, the city council, city manager, the police chief got together this week to roll out a new development program called Corridors of Opportunity, and they gathered at one of the six identified corridors, Beatty's Ford Road. What is this program all about? Glenn.
Well, in short, it's about areas of our city that have been neglected. Corridors of Opportunity is a very euphemistic way of saying areas that we have ignored. We've ignored them as city officials. We've ignored them as a business community, and we've ignored them as media. And so now there is an effort to address some of these areas. Given the upward mobility studies, given the escalating crime rates, given so many things that are happening in these areas, I think elected officials are finally seeing that something has to be done, that there is a correlation between these areas that have been neglected and crime. There is a correlation between these areas that have been neglected education and upward mobility. So in this year's city council budget, I think $24.5 million was set aside to address economic and social issues in these five areas, Beatty's Ford Road corridor being one of the six.
As you said, $24.5 million. Along Beatty's Ford Road, they revealed revitalization plans spanning from I-77 to the old Dalebrook Professional Center just south of I-85. We have about a minute. What are they doing and what are they planning in that corridor?
Well, there are a number of things going on in that corridor. As you know, the streetcar line is going to go up just past Johnson C. Smith University. Mm-hmm. But there are also many examples of individuals, many of whom live or work in that area, coming together to invest their own dollars to bring about economic change along the corridor. But it's not just about economic development. It's about better policing, better code enforcement, all of the issues that contribute to urban decay, if you will, and keep families from achieving their best lives.
Let me stop you. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about that when we return. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, Annie Ma from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE. Mayor Lyles was on the program on Wednesday. She said that one thing they hope to accomplish with this revitalization and this Corridors of Opportunity program is building trust, not just in police, but in every other aspect of government.
These are things that are an investment of human capital, and that's where we've got to start. I wish most of all for our community to be a leader in efforts that address the people's needs, not just the needs of the loudest, not just the needs of the people that have already been successful, but the people in this community that need a decent place to live, a job that they can have, and a possibility that they can raise their families. And what we have to do is start with those people to build trust.
And City Manager Marcus Jones acknowledged there will be skepticism in these targeted communities.
Those of you who have been in this community for more than a day or two, we'll say, what's different? We've seen pictures, we've seen plans, we've heard speeches, we've heard messages, and our commitment to you is we are doing something different this time.
On this program yesterday, Sean Ahmad, who works for a hotel group that operates a hotel in another of these opportunity zones along I-85 at Sugar Creek near Reagan Drive, he gave voice to that skepticism.
Yes, the city, they'll go in and they'll beautify the area a little bit, but they won't actually go to the root cause of it, of what's actually going on in the area and actually helping out the people that are associated with that area. As far as the residents, it can't just be all fast food places. It can't just all be hotels. The city has to come in and provide some kind of incentive for other businesses to come in. They have to come in, provide some kind of incentive for a larger grocery store to come in to, to provide healthier meal options for these residents.
So Glenn, what is the level of skepticism within these communities that, that the city will actually follow through on this promise and it will improve their lives, as opposed to what I think some people have expressed, the fear of gentrifying these areas and they'll have to move?
I think you hit the nail right on the head, Mike. I think the initial skepticism is that residents aren't sure that this is being done for them. Many of these areas are close to downtown. A lot of the other close-in areas are now built out. And so people who are looking to move and be closer to work or closer to the city, certainly before COVID, they are looking at now the Bates Ford Road corridor, West Boulevard, some of these other close communities. And so there's a real suspicion that that a lot of this work is being done or at least that the net effect will be that others will come in and those who are there now will be displaced.
Are there safeguards in place so that this gentrification doesn't happen? So that, because the mayor just talked about wanting to build trust in all aspects of government in an environment where trust in government is being lacerated almost every single day, nationally speaking. So are there safeguards in place to see to it that this does what it says it's going to do?
Well, there are no surefire ways. This is a market economy after all. And market economies do what market economies do. That said, city and county government, they have implemented modest programs to help people stay in their homes and in certain cases. But when areas change rapidly, property values go up, speculators come in, and market forces simply take over.
So this is going to happen, period. Done, right?
I think it's going to happen in some areas much faster than others. Okay. I think it will happen first and foremost in those areas that are close to uptown Charlotte. Areas that are farther away may take a little longer.
Are they rolling out these opportunity corridors all at once, or are they doing them one at a time so that they can see if something is going on that they don't like in the Bates Ford corridor, for instance, they see gentrification happening, that they can modify the plan so it doesn't happen in the other five?
I don't know if there's a unified plan, if you will, for this rollout. As you mentioned, Bates Ford Road, for a number of reasons, is well ahead of some of the other corridors, not the least of which is the fact that the streetcar is coming there. So there are some factors at play. I think they will be watching what happens in the Bates Ford Road corridor, but I don't think necessarily that there is a single game plan for each of that would work in each corridor.
So a couple of weeks ago, ethics complaints were filed against several council members. Two were filed by the state GOP against two Democrats on council, and the city attorney decided to refer those allegations, I think, I'm not sure what the proper term here is, we'll talk about this, to an outside investigator and expressed unease with the current ethics policy. The attorney did. As of several days ago, every person on council, every single person on council has had ethics allegations filed against them. Steve, what is happening here?
So I think it's a little bit like the coronavirus, right? We're in the middle of this outbreak of ethics complaints that started with one or two. And now, like you said, there's now 14. And the city attorney's position is that this goes back to Patrick Cannon's arrest when the city changed its ethics policy. And the previous city attorney, Bob Hageman, said he did not want to be in the practice of investigating his bosses, which are the council members. So they put in this policy that all complaints would be forwarded to an outside investigator. Now they're going through this semantics where they want to change it to outside counsel to try and strip the word investigation out of a headline. you know, I do think it's interesting. I mean, right now we're in a period in the news cycle where, like you said, there's been 14 investigations. Well, no one's written about those, and
yeah,
we've all moved on.
Are most of these 2 years, frivolous?
There will be new beat reporters covering all this, and right, there'll be new allegations. Boom, they will all make it.
So is there precedence for this? Does this happen in a normal year? And what are these ethics complaints about? Because somebody on council said they can file a complaint if they don't like the fact that I wear a vest.
Well, part of what's going on here is that this system was put in place, as Steve said, in 2015. And the setup was that the public could file a complaint. You know, it had to be a specific complaint. And had to have the details of why they thought this was a violation. But I don't think that the public really knew to a great extent that they could do this. And all of a sudden it's been, I guess the council term, the popular term is weaponized, which is you sort of have this proxy war going on involving whether it's rivalries or partisan feuds. And so that's how you get from 2 to all of a sudden 14. And now council is trying to figure out what to do while they're worried about managing their reputations because they don't like the word investigation. So it's just turned into a big mess.
So Steve, council voted to retroactively change the policy so that complaints already filed would face review from outside counsel instead of an independent investigator. Can you change a policy retroactively? Is that law? Can you do that?
That's a good question. I guess so. I mean, I think, you know, before the investigator, I believe Eric, you know, I think I've got this right, was going to be an outside attorney.
Right.
So they've kind of like, I think the policy and what's going to happen is the same. They've just tried to repackage it, give it a new brand. So I guess you can rebrand midstream.
So there are 14 ethics complaints that have been filed in just the last couple of weeks. In a normal year, how many ethics complaints are filed against city council members by members of the public? Do we know?
That's a good question. I mean, this all sort of surfaced as an issue after we had the fight about Carolina FinTech Hub and Councilman Bakari and whether that workplace program would be allowed. And then all of a sudden, we've gotten into this ethics back and forth. And Steve, I don't know if you remember, or Glenn, I can't remember this being an issue in the last 5-10 years.
No. Okay. Along with that, City Council had time to do other things this week. They took up a couple of other issues. They gave their blessing to a bus-only lane experiment on Central Avenue from Eastland to Eastway beginning in October. Why? Why do they want to conduct this experiment?
So I think that I think that you're looking for ways to move people quickly and efficiently that doesn't involve tearing up streets like we're doing with the streetcar. And I mean, I think the question is whether this will be kind of a signal that the phase one and the phase two of the streetcar, I mean, is this possible a wind down for that project and that that we move forward with more bus and more express bus? I don't know. I just know that there is some frustration on council with how the streetcar has moved forward and how difficult it's been.
Because they are considering extending this, if it works, from I guess, Eastway to downtown in 2021. Is this to reduce congestion? Is it to perk up ridership on CATS? Both?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the end game here is that you are hopefully reducing the environmental impact while you're motivating people to take public transit because it's faster, because they don't have to sit in traffic.
And they also discussed a violence interruption program on the Bates Ford Road and LaSalle corridors. They are two of the, I think, 5 identified hotspots for crime that were identified several months ago. How would this violence interruption program work? I know it's based on something that's been going on elsewhere.
There are a number of factors involved in that. Part of it is just instituting more and better communication between residents and police. But it's also about, if you will, some wraparound services that actually would start with people who are who are incarcerated, reaching out to those people, trying to find ways to settle disputes other than through retaliation. There are a number of different factors that they're using to try to reduce crime in those hotspots that you talk about, which coincidentally have some overlap with the corridors of opportunity.
And CMPD has talked about this working in other cities. Go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Very quickly, Annie, the city manager also proposed at that council meeting spending $1 million of CARES Act money to provide Wi-Fi access hotspots for CMS students. They need $4 million to do this. CMS Foundation is committing two. Big Business is donating one. And this would be an additional $1 million to fill it out. Did the council say yes to that?
They did, yeah.
And so if we go back to school in a couple of weeks, is that a waste of money or will this just stay in place permanently and be a valuable asset for kids in areas that don't have internet?
I think that's definitely true, but it's not going to be a waste of money because CMS can't bring all kids back for in-person instruction by the governor's order. At the most saturated the schools will be one-third in-person and two-thirds rotating through virtual instruction. So they'll need internet access anyways.
Okay. Well, President Trump came to Winston-Salem on Tuesday night, his third visit to the state in just over 2 weeks. He held a rally in front of what appeared to be several hundred supporters.
I don't know how many people here, but there's a lot. We said, let's keep it down. They didn't do too good a job, but that's good, right? That's good.
Well, no. That's not. The president was in violation of the state's coronavirus restrictions, including that on crowd sizes, which flies in the face of how he is positioning himself as a law and order candidate. If the state can close bars for months, limit restaurant capacities, close movie theaters, deny David Tepper's request to put 12,000 people in the stands in a 75,000-seat outdoor stadium, why can't they stop the president from holding a rally? It's being done in other states. Steve?
So I asked the governor's office this, and then their answer was, well, he wasn't breaking the order because he was using the First Amendment exemption. So they were like saying, well, this is like a reopen protest or a Black Lives Matter protest, which the truth is, of course, they just can't stop him. I mean, they're powerless and they
were
able to stop.
Whoa. Michigan stopped him.
Well, I mean, that's a good question. But I think there was a huge rally in Michigan, too, just recently with looked like thousands of people as well. Or I guess maybe they feel like they do not want to go through the optics of trying to stop it. Whereas they, with the RNC, it was such a slow process and it was such a drawn out that they were able to have some leverage.
Yeah, he kind of rubbed that in our face too, because he pointed at Tom Tillis and said, only 10 people at a time in a place, right? He assailed his opponent, Joe Biden, as a left-wing extremist, even as he has pardoned convicted criminals in his administration. And he said, I'm running for re-election to put criminals behind bars. And he bragged about his handling of the coronavirus.
We did the right thing. We saved millions of lives. People don't realize we saved millions of lives.
That was the night before the Bob Woodward tapes of President Trump saying otherwise came out. We're a military state, and he's also made comments allegedly about the military. So when you take these two things together, is this going to have any impact at all on this race? Or is it just going to be another in a string of things that are completely ignored?
I can tell you on November 4th.
That was helpful. Thank you very much. He also, we'll leave it at that because we're kind of running out of time here. And I'll give you the last word, Eric. Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal. He wins the prize today for the last word. He's senior managing editor there. Glenn Berkins is founder publisher of QCityMetro.com. Annie Ma, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, who's been very busy this week. And Steve Harrison, our political reporter here for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.